we might just get started. So welcome, my name's Julian Savulescu. I'm the Uehiro Chair in Practical Ethics, and this is the Uehiro series of lectures in Practical Ethics that appears in a book with OUP. Our previous lecturers have been Jonathan Glover gave the first one, Peter Singer, Tony Cody, Jeff McMahon, Francis Cam, and Alan Buchanan. And this year's lecturer is Professor Masaki Ichinose. He is the Professor of Philosophy at the University of Tokyo. His research interests include causation, probability, and the concept of a person. His publications include, in 1997, The Rise of Person Knowledge Theory, The Moment of John Locke, published by the University of Tokyo Press. In 2001, The Labyrinth of Cause and Effect, published by Keiso Publishing Company. In 2006, The Labyrinth of Cause and Reason, The Philosophy of Because, again published by Keiso Publishing. In 1998, he won the Watsuji Tetsuro Prize of Culture and the Nakamura Hajime Prize. Well, unfortunately, having had this chair for many years, my Japanese is still appalling. At this point, I would like to express our deep appreciation and thanks to the Uehiro Foundation on Ethics and Education, the Chairman Eiji Uehiro, who have sponsored the lectures, and indeed the Chair and the Centre. It's a great pleasure to welcome Masaki to give the first of three lectures on the topic of modes of responsibility. The second lecture will be on Monday, the 22nd of November at 12:30 at the Philosophy Faculty. And the third lecture, Death, Penalty and Human Rights, will be at St Cross College at 5:30 on the 25th of November, followed by drinks. Tonight the topic is who is a victim of homicide. Saki, welcome.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to say I really appreciate the kind invitation and the kind arrangement of Julian Savulescu, Professor Savulescu, and the Uehiro Centre of Oxford. So I am given just 15 minutes. So I have to be in rush, so...
No, you have 50.
50, of course, you have 50 minutes. So let me begin. I simply talk following the script I expressed in my PDF file. So my lecture concerned with the issue of criminal responsibility. I will introduce first three viewpoints corresponding to three basic modes constituting criminal responsibility, namely victims, offenders, punishment. My idea might be quite rough at this moment. I'm simply aimed at proposing new perspectives as to each mode of criminal responsibility. I might not directly discuss the issues of responsibility, but I will argue about those three modes, as it were, surrounding the outer edge of the issue of responsibility. Today, I will discuss a fundamental issue concerning the status of victim by focusing upon the case of homicide, that is the most serious crime. So I focus on homicide today. I raise the next question as a starting point in arguing about criminal responsibility. Who is a victim of homicide? At first glance, it sounds stupid, as the answer seems to be too evident. Isn't the victim of homicide nothing but the very person killed? Who else is a victim? Bereaved family and other people concerned is possibly a kind of victim. However, what I'm raising is the question about the direct victim of homicide. Direct victim, who is killed? Bereaved family are not killed. Actually, we can't affirm that all of the bereaved family suffer serious harm or loss to the same extent, because they do not always have loving family relationships. And actually, the murder happened between family members. It's not so strange. And there are people who are all alone in this world, so no one related would exist if they were killed. Consequently, the direct victim of homicide must be the very person killed, as far as we accept the meaningfulness of the concept of a victim of homicide. However, what kind of status does the concept of a victim have, concept of victim in general have? Definitely, there are persons that were harmed. There are persons that complain of pains caused by the harm and ask for punishment of offenders and relief from the harm. It is conceptually a necessary condition for victims that they must be the being to which harm can be ascribed. Therefore, what cannot be the subject of harm and interest, like fictitious beings, Mickey Mouse, or physical object, a piece of iron, cannot be victims. Then, how about victims of homicide? According to literal meaning of the concept, victims of homicide have already died, such as a logical implication. They don't exist as subject of harm and interest when they are mentioned as victim of homicide. So question, are they truly victims? It is true that they exist in the process of being killed, but they no longer exist. They passed away and disappeared. Those issues are definitely one of the philosophical problems about how to talk about dead people, which is usually discussed in terms of posthumous indifference and posthumous predication. I will generically call both of them posthumous expression. To regard people who are killed and exist nowhere as victims is to take a sentence like this to be a meaningful one that is successful at posthumous expressions. First example, P1, Mr. A, who was miserably stabbed to death. We are regretful. A few years ago, in Akihabara in Tokyo, do you know, maybe you know the name of Akihabara, many people were stabbed to death by one crazy man. So I made this example remembering such tragedy. In this case, Mr. A is a posthumous difference and really feels regretful is a posthumous predication. This natural way of a posthumous expression leads to the depths of the problem of death. Every posthumous expression does not always cause a difficulty. Next example, Galileo Galilei was apologized by Roman Catholic Church in 1992. Such kind of a posthumous expression is definitely understandable as far as historical descriptions like those are normally acceptable. Easily acceptable posthumous expressions like P2 could be applied even to a killed person. Third example, John Lennon, still now at last, many of us, but as you know, John Lennon was killed. Few people doubt the intelligibility of P3, as this is a typical example of descriptions about historic figures. However, when it comes to the case involving some evaluation or emotional characterization of killed people or dead people, rather than mere posthumous reference or predication in a descriptive way, the situation appears different. The first example mentioned above is one example, and another example. My deceased father always watches over me. This PE4 ascribes some value of goodness or benevolence to my deceased father. Likewise, the PE1 attributes emotional characterization of feeling regretful to Mr. A. They should be called a posthumous evaluation rather than posthumous reference or posthumous predication. Problems about posthumous expressions are closely connected with epistemological and ontological issues like ontology of non-existence, historical knowledge, possible world, fiction, counterfactual concern, and so on. Actually, for instance, problems on posthumous expressions could be treated as one corollary of the problem of non-existence, which has been discussed since Alexius Meinong proposed the study of objects, Gegenstand theory then. Or posthumous expressions could be studied as a problem that presupposes a certain possible world where dead people are still alive. Or posthumous expressions could be made as historical descriptions as PE2 exemplified. Here I will focus upon a certain proper way of thinking appearing along posthumous expressions. So, section 2, the harmlessness theory of death. So, the problem arises, namely, how could we find it possible to attribute values about emotion or interest to dead people, in particular, to killed people? How should we understand such characterization as that killed people suffer pains, feel regretful, or are vexed? If our common view turns out homicide gives the maximum amount of harm to its victim, namely, people are the most seriously harmed by being killed, we have to answer these questions in order to justify our common view. However, there is a classical objection against this common view. The objection might completely eradicate our common sense of the shallow idea of Raymond. That originates from a famous argument of the Greek philosopher Epicurus and Lucretius. So, this is a very famous argument. Accustom thyself to believe that death is nothing to us, for good and evil imply sentience, and death is the privation of all sentience. Therefore, righteous understanding that death is nothing to us makes the mortality of life enjoyable, not by adding to life an illimitable time. Death, therefore, the most awful of evils, is nothing to us, seeing that when we are, this is not come, and when this is come, we are not. It is nothing. I came to know this argument when I was an undergraduate student. I was shocked, but I was 100% convinced of this. So, and I a bit feel relaxed by knowing this. We have to note 2 points. One, this that Epicurus takes the issue here is a completed condition of having already died or being dead from the very first person's point of view. This of others, as mentioned from the second or third person's point of view, is for the time being outside his consideration. Additionally, as it is clear that Epicurus' argument definitely focuses upon the completed condition of having died, we can easily understand that the process of being dying is not what matters. Actually, in general, three modes of death tend to be distinguished in the context of the metaphysics of death. Dying, death, being dead. Dying is a process of death, so people haven't died yet. Being dead is a completed situation, as represented by a corpus, or bones. And this is a middle point between dying and being dead. This is a standard interpretation. Of course, it is unavoidable that the slightest paradox arises as to where the boundary is. But in any case, Epicurus focuses upon the being dead and death rather than dying. Dying is not his matter. Second note, Epicurus presupposes from the outset that the sensation or its consciousness does not exist at all in any sense after death. As his declaration, this is a privation of all sentience, shows. What kind of basis or foundation does this presupposition have? Anyway, Epicurus' main point is quite clear. This is no existence, so that this is harmless and cannot be the object of fear. To put it another way, this cannot be directly perceived or experienced, or maybe by definition, the subject of sensation or experience disappears by this, so that there is no sensation of being harmed. Therefore, harm of this is intrinsically impossible or contradictory to the very meaning of the word itself. I will call this argument the harmlessness of death, HLTD hereafter. So following Rosenbaum's clarification, I will formulate HLTD in the next way. So the first presupposition is the most basic. A state of affairs S is bad for person P only if P can experience it at some time. And then, conclusion that peace being dead is not bad for people. This argument is quite persuasive in its own way. Actually, this is sometimes supposed to be an escape from any pain or harm, therefore to be not bad, as understood in the context of discussion of euthanasia. So, possibly non-existence of a victim. Question, what would happen if HLTD must be accepted, and we apply HLTD to the issue of a killed person, we must reach an absolutely preposterous conclusion. Killed people or victims of homicide have suffered no harm at all. Not only that, intrinsically they are not persons or victims at all. Killed people who are dead can be neither any victims of harm nor any beneficiary of interest. Victims of homicide or dead people in general are nothing. They have already disappeared. However, if we accept this consequence and apply it to the actual case of homicide could be just a pettier crime than non-fatal violence, like hitting someone to have a nosebleed. In the case of the violence, the victim is really present with trying to stop the nosebleed by a handkerchief. Whereas in the case of homicide, a direct victim doesn't exist. Probably we could insist that nothing happens or that nothing was done when or after the homicide was committed. So this is an extremely counterintuitive implications. However, as far as we find HLTD somehow persuasive, we should logically reach those kinds of eccentric views. In addition, HLTD ultimately drew a monstrous conclusion how to punish offenders who committed a homicide. Because there is no victim of homicide, according to HLTD, no punishment ought to be inflicted to the offender. Exactly speaking, there is no offender either. Therefore, the death penalty is usually supposed to be applied only to offenders of homicide because of the existence of the most seriously harmed victims. We should conclude that the concept of death penalty is impossible. Well, I like to call this kind of view the impossibilist view of death penalty. This impossibilist view could be supported by HLTD from another angle as well. The death penalty is conducted by definition in terms of a condemned convict being executed, namely being killed. However, HLTD claims that the moment a person dies, the person disappears and doesn't exist. If it is the case, the death penalty should be thought to be a punishment to nobody. In this sense as well, the death penalty must be understood as conceptually impossible. And in fact, I will discuss the issue in my third talk from another angle. So should we adopt that monstrous view of treating homicide as a petty crime? Is it morally permissible for offenders of homicide to receive no serious punishment at all? So, of course, bereaved families, the problems of bereaved families. How should we treat feeling of being harmed or feeling of loss? That bereaved family or people related to killed persons often suffer. HLTD could provide these 2 points. First, HLTD could maintain that if those feelings denote the present psychological situation of those people after the homicide, then HLTD could assert that those are just a fabricated feeling without any substance. But this is a nonsense comment, because if we accept this, the concept of loss becomes absolutely meaningless. So second, possible reaction from HLTD. HLTD could provide another reaction, that is to say the feeling of loss that bereaved family or related people suffer is not special one, but just a kind of emotion which universally and equally applies to the situation in general where something was lost. So in reality, this point surely has a certain possessiveness. Even when we lose something material by fire or theft, the loss could cause the maximum amount of the feeling of being harmed, depending upon what loss things are. For instance, Japanese emperors, three sacred emblems, this is their identity. So if they lose that, that's a big harm. On the contrary, even if family members killed, there might be, as a matter of fact, given fact that the case in which they don't feel so much sad. So we cannot say a priori that the feeling of being harmed or the feeling of lost bereaved family or people concerned suffer is particularly a special emotion to which our society should pay a special institutional attention. However, of course, it is not difficult to imagine that many people take HLTD to be unacceptable, because the claim of HLTD that there is no victim at all in the case of homicide and no direct harm happens there sounds totally bizarre. So many philosophers try to refute HLTD. So the most famous argument in order to refute HLTD is called what is called the deprivation theory. So let's come back to the formulation of HLTD. Exactly speaking, there are only three premises. So the first premise is the most important. If I could prove this first premise to be false, we could refute HLTD smoothly. So in that case, it's okay for us to raise such an example as some harm that is really harmful from the first person point of view, in spite of being incapable of experience. So in this context, Thomas Nagel is a famous example, but I skip this. So following this line of argument, we could insist that this is also a kind of phenomenon that is really harmful to the very person who died, despite the person being incapable of experiencing that, because this deprives us of many good things, many valuable things, like those three examples. So this view, criticism against HLTD is called the deprivation theory of tests, badness. I like to raise question against the deprivation theory. Does this deprivation theory really refute the first assumption of HLTD? Unfortunately, I don't believe so. Many objections could be raised, and I skip one. The most crucial objection against the deprivation theory is a very simple one. This is a killer technique of HLTD. Who suffers from such kind of deprivation? Whose deprivation of good things matters? Who or whose? In facing this question, deprivation theory is stuck. No possibility to answer. Of course, there are many challenges to rescue the deprivation theory. So the symmetry problem is raised as a criticism against the deprivation theory from the side of HLTD, and I skipped it. And against the symmetry problem, for instance, the scholars like Derek Parfit in Oxford raised an asymmetry argument to defend the deprivation theory. But that's concerned. And, I'll come back to the script. To be honest, I like to agree with this result of HLTD by 80%. This is my position in this talk. I agree with HLTD by 80%, but 20% I don't agree with. It's ambiguous, but this is the nature of this topic. So, because death is this topic, today's topic, and nobody among us have experienced death. So, in exactly speaking, nobody knows what death is. So, argument about death has a kind of ambiguity. It's a nature of this topic. So, I agree with HLTD by 80%, but 20% not ugly. So that's ambiguous, but this is the nature of this topic. Because it is absolutely true that dead people or killed people doesn't exist in the same manner as living people, and that dead people or killed people are never taken care of in our society with regard to the right to vote, a census of the population, social welfare like a pension, and so on. In this sense, if the death penalty was justified somehow in terms of a retributive way of thinking, presuming some existence of killed people like the living, that killed victim has a right to retaliate the offender who kills them, the system of death penalty must face a serious difficulty to maintain its raison d'etre. But I will discuss the death penalty today and in my third lectures, but I'm afraid that the death penalty is already abolished in this country. So this is off the point, I will justify myself later. So next, I would like to raise my own point that is called the harm gradation theory. However, I cannot be fully convinced of the view resulting from HLTD, the 20% I disagree with HLTD. My ambivalent feeling and hesitation are caused by the fact that some temporal duration entailed by the concept of harm is not fully reflected in HLTD. As far as I understand, the first presumption to the formulation of HLTD, that is, a state of affairs S is bad for person P only if P can experience it at some time, represent harm as synchronic or momentary pain or suffering. Bodily pain that comes up this moment is taken to be a symbolic image of the concept of pain in HATD. Basically, I don't disagree with such the synchronic or momentary status of harm. That status must be the basis of the concept of harm. But what I feel hesitant about is my doubt about whether harm could be understood only as having this momentary status or not. What I have in mind is the case that we endure some amount of harm or pains now in order to realize the value of end in the future, was the case that we spent quite enjoyable time in the past, but that lead to a miserable result afterwards, whereby the past enjoyable time is regarded as a sort of harm retrospectively. Many examples. The case that we pick up these pains of hunger for the sake of dieting, the case that we came to remember the very important task to be finished by the previous night in the morning after having spent a pleasant dinner the previous evening. The case of liver transplant from a living donor for their family member, so on. Of course, the basis of harm, including those cases just mentioned, undoubtedly lies in the synchronic experience of harm in the present, only on the basis of which problems of harm and interest in the past or in the future could make sense. Nonetheless, it seems we cannot declare that harm is nothing but the momentary experience in the present. So, this is my view. Harm seems to be some kind of gradational phenomenon whose density is the maximum of the present. That is the moment the harm comes, and the more distant from the maximum point towards the past or the future, the more diluted it is. Moreover, such kind of gradational phenomenon seems to be an overall process, organically connected with each other, where if one end of the process is changed, the change gives feedback to the maximum point at the center. For instance, when some harm comes at the present, the harm extends its gradational effect to the past with the thought that if we had not done such and such, this kind of harm would not have come. With an expectation of what kind of difficulty would be brought about by the present harm, the gradational process would be extended to the future. Or by expecting a good result caused by the present harm, we might find that the good result could give feedback to the present, and the degree of harm at the present would be diluted. We could recognize such sort of organic connection among the gradational process of harm. So I call this the harm gradation theory, HGT. In other words, I assert that harm, interest, and the benefits are a kind of narrative phenomenon, which makes sense in the diachronic rather than synchronic context of design, plan, and history, rather than the synchronic context of momentary occurrence. This is true of even bodily pains. Of course, the temporal duration of pain may be mentioned, but not only should that be referred to. So, terrible toothache is a representative of pains, but the toothache may be very favorable for those who want to cancel the business plan for some reason. To a person who is rescuing someone in a self-sacrifice way by throwing their own body away, that painful action itself might include a certain factor of pleasure with a feeling of self-absorption. So, harm or experience of harm is such a phenomenon that it appears in the form of gradation or is always altered, constructing the gradation in the diachronic narrative from the past to the future. So that if the first presumption of HATD didn't cover phenomena of this harm gradation as well, HATD must be supposed to have some drawbacks, although slightly. Obviously, HGT is applicable to the case of killed people. Besides a rare case of being killed instantly, they definitely experience the harm of dying in a more miserable way than normal dying. At that time, experienced harm is gradationally extended to their past history in the form of counterfactual conditionals. If they had not done so and so, they might not have been killed, or to their final tragedy in the immediate future. However, once their lives end and discount, their experience disappears from the present harm constituting the maximal density of harm suddenly vanishes. Therefore, this is not harmful according to HATD. But adopting HGT, even if discounts and the maximal density of harm momentarily vanishes, lower density of harm could be ascribed to the past time before they died. HDD supposes that there will be a remnant of the maximum density of harm lingering for some time just after their death. Okay? Oh, this argument cancels the three distinction between three modes of death. So, against HDD, HDD must suddenly raise the standard question, to whom is such a lower density of harm ascribed? Who suffered such a lower density of harm after the very person was killed? That is nothing but the killer technique of HDD. In order to answer those severe questions, I will propose two arguments. So we ought to put forward appropriate ontology of killed or dead people. So there are some attempts to raise some kind of ontology of dead people. So I will skip those, but I mentioned two kind of attempts to raise ontology of dead people. One is what is called Cambridge change. And the next one is four-dimensional framework. Four-dimensional framework is, as the name shows, we look at the old time from a bird's eye point of view. So in the past event has some ontological status which is preserved in an eternal sense. So in that, if we adopt such kind of ontology, we can ascribe the ontological status to the dead people. So dead people is harmed as a become a meaningful if we adopt four-dimensional framework. Well, this is a very popular one. So I generically called such kind of reactions like Cambridge change or three, four-dimensional framework, ontological reactions. However, if we apply ontological reaction to the case of homicide, it's getting hold of the ontological status of dead people is counterintuitive, because such a strategy obfuscates the most basic question of the issue of homicide. That is to say, why homicide actually matters so seriously, despite the fact that the direct victim disappeared by definition. Deprivation theory, although it finally fails, at least takes the question seriously. In contrast with DD, deprivation theory, ontological reaction is so keen to evade HLTD that they introduce some ontological status of dead people, which results in no necessity to raise the question of why homicide matters, as dead people still exist in a certain sense according to ontological reaction. At this point, feeling of dead people's disappearing and being completely separated cannot be highlighted according to ontological reaction. Consequently, DT and OR are two approaches contrasting each other, both of which attempt to rescue our talking about dead people from HLTD. Are most not exempt from fundamental difficulties, even though both have certain theoretical advantages. So then let's come back to HDT. My purpose of examining ontological reactions to seek ontology of posthumous expressions supporting HDT. But how could we establish such kind of ontology? As I said, HDT is a theory claiming that harm is a kind of gradational phenomenon whose density is the maximum of the present, and the more distant from the maximum point towards the past or the future, the more diluted it is. Moreover, such kind of gradational phenomenon seems to be an overall process organically connected with each other, where if one end of the process is changed, the change gives feedback to the maximum point at the center. Adopting HDT, even if death comes and the maximum density of harm momentarily vanishes, lower density of harm could be ascribed to the past time. HDT supposes that there will be a remnant of a maximum density of harm lingering after their death. What I focus upon first as the HDT is the fact that the maximum density of harm at a certain time in the past is, as a matter of fact, causally connected with the present circumstance in many forms. That's why I referred to remnant. So, for example, we might find a scratch made in agonies by female's nails when the person was killed, or confusion of furniture done by the killed person when the person was dying. Those kind of things exist at present as a causal result from experienced harm of dying in the past. Perhaps those results could ultimately cause a sense of grief near the related people, which is a quite realistic feeling of sadness and separation. HDT sheds light on the causal process that diachronically lasts from the maximal density of harm at the time of being killed in the past via its remnant to our sense of grief, and chooses the causal process itself as an ontological unit for posthumous expressions. This view is in some sense analogous to the famous argument proposed by Wesley Salmon as regards causation, because Wesley Salmon emphasized causal propagation as a sum process. So harm gradation theory is a causal theory, where it could be said that the notion of causality is interpreted in a similar way to Salmon's. And unlike HFTD, that pays attention only to synchronic and momentary phenomena, HGT considers diachronic and draining process caused by harm. This kind of ontology is not extraordinary, as there are many examples of ordinary objects whose ontological structure is exactly the same as the causal process that I have introduced. A planet that is thousands of millions of light years far from the Earth, the planet that we are seeing is one in the exceedingly remote past. Nevertheless, we basically treat the planet as an object in the present. The same story applies in principle to any object of sight, hearing, and smelling. For those perceptual objects are basically a bit distant from us, so that it takes some time, although very, very short, for these causal processes from object to our perceptual understanding to obtain. However, we usually regard those objects as being at present perceived right now. But this situation itself suggests at least slight possibility that, for example, a cause of a scratch or confusion of furniture, namely killed person, is supposed to be at present, or more strictly speaking, at least a part of the process existing or extending at present. So I have already proposed substantial parts of my talk, but this is another interesting part. So I have some minutes. Okay, I will introduce this interesting point. And I'm always think of this topic, but I'm not a native speaker of English, so it's a good occasion for me to ask about this in front of native speakers of English. This is a topic related to the word person. Even if we admit the ontology of HGT, a simple objection against HGT may be made by raising this question. Doesn't HGT blur who suffers lower density of harm at present? Has the person concerned already died and never existed from their first person's point of view, so that the person couldn't suffer any harm? This question is obviously crucial, conforming to HLTD. However, it seems to me that we could somehow answer this question in terms of reconsidering what the concept of person intrinsically means. The word personality or person, as is well known, comes from a Latin word, persona, which means mask. And the persona, at least partly, originates from another Latin verb, persona, whose infinitive is personale. According to your Latin dictionary, persona is from persona, to sound through, with a second syllable, lengthened. As is suggested, persona means to sound through and through, to resound, to make a sound, or to cry out, call aloud. Actually, persona is a combination of two words, that is, per, which means through, and sonus, which means sound. So, for example, there are two famous Japanese companies of electronic machines, Sony and Panasonic. But Sony means obviously originated from the sonus. And Panasonic, Pana means all, and Panasonic, of course, all sounds. So Sony and Panasonic, it's a very good name to represent audio machine or something like that. So we should notice that, grammatically speaking, persona is a present singular imperative of personale. We might say that the concept of person is originally something musical, which is very different from the concept of individual. This is a Western one, so. So for instance, Scala gives this remark. Let's look at the meaning complex for the term. Person. The term is derived from the Latin persona, from which semantically subtended to ideas that form its core meaning. One of the ideas is suggested by personale, meaning to sound through, as in the case of the voice of an actor resounding through a mask. And I'm personally interested in singing. Well, I don't sing, but I like to listen to singing in a classical orchestra. And in the study of singing, there is a concept which is called maschera in Italian. The maschera is a kind of technique of singing which suggests that giving a voice, turning, giving a voice, hit the mask and turn back to their own body. So it's resulting in a very beautiful voice, maybe. So it's a kind of technique which is called maschera in Italian. And as this kind of issue shows, the mask is a kind of device to change voice or some effect on the voice. So if this is a correct in claiming the intrinsic connection between person and persona, a mask, as I said, persona, that an actor or an actress wears in plays seems to be used as a sort of loudspeaker or equalizer. In fact, that musical status of a person or persona follow that thus far is also confirmed in the contemporary discussion about music or about the aesthetic of music. The musical usage of persona probably originates from argument in Edward Kant, the composer's voice. Now, this is the topic in the field of ethics of music. Kant introduced three aspects of persona as a musical subject by saying there is thus a triad of personas or person-like figures involved in the accompanying song, the vocal, the instrumental, and the complete musical. Following this, Naomi Cumming, she's also a scholar in the field of aesthetics of music, Naomi, but she unfortunately died when she was 14 years. Naomi Cumming argues about the synthesis of voice and voices in musical utterance and asserts in her the sonic self. So, if a quasi personal utterance or a persona is heard in this combination of signs, it is now one whose expressive impulse is offered a degree of containment by its relationship to broader tonal goals. The persona can be apprehended as a complexly whole yet singular character whose synthesis as one is an ongoing process in musical time, responsive to new information as it is heard, and thus mutable in its emergent qualities. If this is the case, we should take the person to be a subject who makes voice or sound, like actors, to pass it to others. In other words, a person is, etymologically speaking, a person is a being resonating with us, the status of person is quite radically different from the notion of individual. As far as we take this original connotation of the concept of person seriously or experimentally, we should never regard even the first person as a completely isolated existence from others. Incidentally, in order to make my argument on this mutual concept of person more persuasive, I have to face a question about how to make the theory fit the modern definition of the concept of person, which was initially established by John Locke in terms of consciousness. But I'm interested in this kind of topic, but I skip it here. Thus, even if a person is killed and suddenly falls into non-existence, his or her personhood, resonant with others, is supposed to remain for some time, even though slightly, as reverberation, which was initially caused by original sounds or voice. In this gradational process of reverberation, harm interpreted in some sounds of sound or voice, which came when that very person was killed and dying, continued to be left, although gradually becoming fainter sound. Of course, it eventually gets almost imperceptible, that is, causing no sense of grief, when only objective and historical descriptions are left. In any case, consequently, if we hope to avoid fully accepting agency and admitting that homicide is just a petty crime, we should invent some appropriate ontology of killed people. I believe that HGT could be one of promising candidates. So I want to emphatically notice ontology of killed people that I have just offered is not radically different from HLTD, because HGT takes the same stance as HLTD in respect of being based upon present harm, as I emphasized. Additionally, our sense of grief as ultimate result of initial harm is eventually, in reality, only a momentary sensation in the personal sense. This is the case. It is absolutely an acceptable attitude to more overwhelmingly focus upon the sensation than pain that living people actually suffer from, or destitution people suffer from caused by some faults. According to HGT, we couldn't justify the view of extremely thinking much of the fact that some people died because of homicide. So, final part. It is true that HGT, unlike HLTD, accepts homicide as a certain degree of offense. In proportion to our sense of grief and the strategy of regarding homicide as relatively the most harmful offense might be consistent with HGT. Thus, it might be admitted in HGT to inflict to offenders of homicide heavier punishments than the one corresponding to the feeling of loss which related to people like bereaved family suffered. In this sense, HGT takes the stance of viewing homicide as a heavier offense than theft or violence, so that HGT should be said to be different from HLTD. However, considering homicide as absolutely special to belong to a different level from other types of offense is not at all what HGT implies. So, as far as this argument is concerned, a treatment of victim of homicide and related punishment seems to rest only on our subjective emotions. But of course, that is not what I intended. My argument only proposed the initial basis of those issues. The argument must be universally institutionalized once the basis is socially acknowledged. In that case, even if bereaved family doesn't have a sense of grief at all, as a loss of their family, the harm gradation theory could be applied in a normative manner to such cases. That's the end. Thank you.
Okay. Very much to time. So we have a prepared response from Professor Ingemar Persson from Gothenburg, who was 3 hours late on the plane, so it just came in a bit of late. I've seen the Hayden before. So I think you've got 10 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up for general questions, and I already see Gerard's hand. So do you want to...
I'm not sure. Do I have a PowerPoint?
Well, I was just wondering that. I know Nick sent it through to here, but I don't know that it's got onto the system. I've just been copying it onto
Maybe...
Bennett is the...
Sorry?
Bennett is the technology
master. Well, Nick did send it through, but I've just taken it from... Because Ingmar asked me to make it into PowerPoint. But we can use
maybe...
Do you want to take charge?
Well, Janet may not have it under control.
I haven't got a VGA.
So just so I'm quite a question, so I've already seen Gerard's got
a question. Actually, no, because if this is a PC, which it is...
This is my PC.
Yeah, but we can't use mine because I haven't got the VGA connector for it.
PDF?
I wasn't. No, not PDF, Word. PowerPoint.
So, do I have a line of questions, or is everyone formulating? Sure. Yep. Okay.
So you haven't. Where does this come up?
Thanks.
No.
Not yet.
It hasn't come up.
Is it on your computer,
Janet? Yeah, but it's the long... The VGA adapters are all different. That won't work. It won't go to that.
You sure?
Yeah.
Yes, it will.
Will it?
Yeah, I used to have one of these.
Just a minute.
We've got
the VGA
adapter.
And he's found it.
If you go under I, just scroll down to IN. Scroll down to IN. You need to get it in.
Newest one?
You need to get it either in date order or.
Yeah, it's date order.
Get it in date order, it's today.
Yeah, newest one.
You saw it?
It is.
There it is.
Yeah, there it is. Yes.
Thank you. If you used to have one of these and that's available, but...
You need to view
that. I have six questions now, so...
Yeah. Why don't you start?
It's this one. Yeah.
Good.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to make some alterations.
Shall I start, or...?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry about this. I've been going, the last 30 years, I've been going from Copenhagen to London at least 100 times, and I can't recall any delay as long as this one. So I'm sorry about that, but Masaki's talk is a very complicated and complex one, and what I should do in this response is to... develop a response to a reply to Epicurus's argument. That's the first thing. And then I shall distinguish that issue from some other issues that Masaki raises. Now, the version of the reply I should give to Epicurus's argument is a version of the deprivation theory, but I shall develop it in a slightly less contentious way than Masaki developed it. Masaki develops it in a way in which it's sort of committed to a theory about well-being, what makes your life, what makes things good for you, which denies hedonism, which Epicurus assumes. It's rather a desire fulfillment theory, which presupposes that it can be good or bad for you if your last will is contravened or satisfied. What I should be doing is sort of develop a deprivation account assuming hedonism and assuming what Epicurus does. Epicurus makes two assumptions, the first assumption being that death deprives you of sentience or consciousness. This is what I've reformulated in the following way. When you're dead, you have irrevocably lost consciousness. The second assumption is the hedonism, which he says that good and evil implies sentience or consciousness. This is how I reformulated as two. When you have irrevocably lost consciousness, nothing can be intrinsically good or bad for you. The reason for that is quite simple. According to hedonism, what's good, intrinsically good, is pleasure. What is intrinsically bad is pain. And if you don't have consciousness, you can't experience pleasure or pain. However, it's still the case that you can have nothing. It's still true that nothing is intrinsically good or bad for you in that state. And now, from those two claims, you can deduce by something that used to be called hypothetical syllogism when I learned logic about 30 years ago in the 70s. I think it's still called that. But anyway, it's a valid inference. It's just therefore, from 1 and 2, when you're dead, nothing can be intrinsically good or bad for you. Now, all of this is what's sort of part of Epicurus' claim. Now comes what I add to it, namely form. When nothing can be intrinsically good or bad for you, this is worse for you than when things are overall intrinsically good for you. Now, the point is simple, that if you compare a state which is neither good nor bad to you, which is, intrinsically speaking, which is intrinsically neutral, that state is worse than a state which is intrinsically good for you. and it's better than a state which is intrinsically bad for you. Now, from those two claims, 3 and 4, you can again deduce that when you're dead, this is worse for you than when things are overall intrinsically good for you. worse than being alive when your life is good overall. If your life had been bad, intrinsically speaking, overall, being dead would be better, since in an intrinsically neutral state, a state which is neither good nor bad. And note that a state being neither good nor bad on hedonism doesn't presuppose consciousness. It presupposes only the absence of consciousness. The absence of consciousness is neither good nor bad, neither pain nor pleasure. So, now, as something harms you when it makes you worse off than you otherwise would be, dying harms you. So, on this account, dying actually do harm you if your life is good. On the other hand, if your life is bad, dying putting you in this intrinsically neutral state would be a benefit, and that explains why euthanasia, a good death, is possible. So I think the crucial point in this connection is that to realize that something can harm you, although it doesn't put you in a state which is intrinsically bad. It's enough for you to be harmed if you're lose benefit if you're removed from a state which is intrinsically good and put in a state which is say, intrinsically neutral. Of course, if it's intrinsically bad, well, that would also be something that harms you. But notice that harming you doesn't presuppose putting you in a state which is intrinsically bad. Similarly, benefiting you doesn't presuppose putting you in a state which is intrinsically good. For that reason, it's possible to sort of harm somebody on this account, which is a deprivation account in the sense that it says that death is worse than a good life because it deprives you of the goodness of life. So, now this is why I think we can reject Epicurus's argument, even if we accept his premises, the conclusion won't follow, because it overlooked that you can harm somebody without putting them in a state which is intrinsically bad. Now, Masaki's account, the harm graduation theory, which I can't say much about here, seems to me to presuppose that what is harmful about death is something which is intrinsically bad. He talks about the experience of dying, so on, which is, in most cases is terrible, of course. The problem about that, as he himself realizes, that you can die without having this experience. You die in your sleep, or you never know what hit you. Death happens instantly. On the other hand, it's also possible that you have this horrible experience of thinking that you're definitely going to die, and you don't do it. Think, for instance, of the famous Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky. I mean, he was led to believe that he would be executed and were brought out in the prison yard. And then they said, well, no, we won't be executed, we'll deport you to Siberia instead. Now, according to Masaki's account, it was in that would be as bad as dying for Dostoevsky. It wouldn't be a benefit to him saying, well, we won't execute you after all. We'll send you to Siberia. On the contrary, that would actually harm you and make things worse for you. And this sort of connects with the point that Masaki makes, that the death penalty, capital punishment, is conceptually impossible. Now, what's conceptually impossible in this case is just that calling something a penalty or capital punishment is a conceptual mistake if you assume that a penalty or a punishment must be something that harms you. On the Epicurus account, it would be impossible for the capital punishment, and death penalty to be a penalty or a punishment if you assume that punishment or penalty must be something that harms you. Now, let's go on. I've talked about the cessation of consciousness. Now, two further issues that Masaki raises, which I think are very different, and I should briefly sort of go through them. Now, this is our old friend, the Epicurean assumption that when you're dead, you've irrevocably lost consciousness. Now, in order to get from that claim to the claim that when you're dead, you cease to exist, another claim Masaki makes, he sort of claims several times that dead people are nothing, they vanished, and so on. Now, in order to get from this claim to that claim, you have to assume that when you have irrevocably lost consciousness, you've ceased to exist. Now, from those two claims, it follows when you're dead, you, a possible victim of homicide, have ceased to exist. Now, the problem with this argument is that six is true on psychological theorists of our nature and identity, theorists assess that we consist in something mental, Lockean account, that we are persons, minds, or consciousness, whatever. It's not true on biological theories of our nature and identity, such theories like saying that we are identical to human organisms. on those theories, there are actually two different, relevantly different kinds of biological views. According to one biological view, we do cease to exist when we die, for reasons that these are people like Eric Olsen and Peter van Inwagen, and they think that what sort of holds your body together in some metaphysical sense is life processes. So if life process, biological life process cease, well, your organism sort of dissolves. But on another version of animalism or biological view, for instance, the view of Fred Feldman and Paul Snowden, human organism goes on existing after death. And I think that is the consensual view, that we have an organism which used to be alive, now it's dead. It continues to exist. Now, that sort of theory, it's not the case that in general that we cease to exist when we die. In certain cases, it's true. Think, for instance, of the 9/11, the victims of 9/11. I mean, there was this enormous heat and the collapsing Twin Towers. Of course, when those people died, they were completely destroyed, annihilated. So whatever view we take on our nature and identity, it was true of them that they ceased to exist when they died. But it's not true in general. Now, one observation which is interesting to make in this connection is to say, irrespective of this dispute, personal identity, it seems rather plausible to say that the victim of a homicide is a human being of flesh and bone rather than mind or consciousness. And on the commonsensical view, that entity goes on existing after you're dead. Now, the further claim Masaki makes, I shall hurry up a bit. When you're dead, you cease to exist. Now, to get from this to a further claim he makes, that we can't refer to dead people. We can't make claims about them, saying that they've been harmed and so on. Now, in order to get to that claim, we need to suppose that when you cease to exist, reference to you becomes impossible. Reference, predication, can't predicate things of dead people. That's a claim he makes. And from that he derives the claim that when you're dead, reference to you becomes impossible. Now, the problem with that argument is, I think, that the claim that when you cease to exist, reference to you is impossible. Now, that flies in the face of everyday experience, because we do talk about things that have ceased to exist all the time. I have a piece of paper, I throw it on the fire, it's consumed by the fire. It doesn't exist anymore, but I can still talk about it. So, verbs, like pointing to something and so on, they presuppose the existence of something. You can point to something only if it exists, even if it has to exist in the neighbourhood. You can't point to Melbourne or something in Australia, but you can refer to it. So why assume that we can't refer to things that don't exist anymore? I think that needs further argument. And also the conclusion Masaki draws that it's impossible to refer to dead people. I mean, it's a pretty impossible conclusion, because think, for instance, of history books. They're full of references to dead people. Now, so I think we need an argument to say that it's impossible to refer to dead people or things that don't exist. And we need that before we can sort of go along with Masaki's theory of remnants, which is supposed to save reference, because in many cases, there won't be any remnants. Remnants would be things like the blood stains on the street when you've been run over, things like that. In many cases, there won't be any remnants. Again, 9/11 victims. Apart from the man who was photographed or filmed when he jumped from high up, there weren't any remnants of those people who were consumed by the extreme heat and so on. So my conclusions are, first, there is a reply to the Epicurean argument. Death does harm us, even if we accept hedonism. And secondly, it's dubious that we cease to exist when we die. But when we do cease to exist, reference to us still seems to be possible. And it still seems to be possible to say, for instance, that we've been harmed or so. All right, thank you very much. Excuse me for being here.
So I think it's probably not wise to respond to every point that Ingemar has, but maybe
He gives many crucial points to my argument. So if I have a little bit of time, I have to lay a reaction to his comments. But basically, his first point is the most crucial. Almost essential for my argument. So, following the deprivation theory, death or dying, or being dead, is a kind of harm. It's a bad for the dead people. So, but
it's comparative.
Comparative bad or comparative intrinsically good. I would like to ask you to remember the main basic point of HATD, which is a killer technique of HATD. So if something is good, even if something is good, to whom it is good? And if something good is lost,
to you?
Who lost?
If you're dead.
But the main point of HATD, Epicurean point, is there is no the who question is ascribed to. There is nothing. So if, even if it is it sounds to be good from some point of view, but to whom it is good. So that's a killer technique of HATD. So deprivation, according to my diagnosis, deprivation theory is not persuasive when we consider such killer technique of HATD. That's a main reaction.
Well, okay, so sorry, because we actually have to be out by 7 p.m. So I want to give some other people a chance. We can pursue this after. Yeah. So Gerard, I think so. If you can keep the questions brief, so to give maximum.
Okay, so I'll just ask one. I have two questions. I'll just ask one. I wanted to give some reasons why you might reject premise one of HLTD. And actually, I should say I really enjoyed the talk because I've got a few friends that really passionately believe in HLTD, and I'm glad to see a defense. But I want to give you some reasons to reject HLTD, and mainly premise one. Because, and one, to remind people of something like badness, you can only be bad if some person, you can only get bad if someone experiences it. And it seems, you know, an odd thing to believe in, because there are lots of cases where badness doesn't seem to depend on sentience at all. For example, when we sort of burn an ancient forest or destroy artwork. And also, we seem to think that there can be harms to people who don't have sentience, so if someone who's in a coma gets raped. And we also think that fictional characters can even get harmed, so this is sort of going against some conceptual work. I mean, if Mickey Mouse has an anvil dropped on their foot, you think Mickey Mouse has been harmed. Even if there's no normative badness to it. So you might have some reasons to reject one. And even to sort of make rejection one strong, you might want to be able to respond to your objections to the response to one that also you raised against Ingmar, where you said that you want to look at who is harmed, right, in order to... And I think that's a mistake. So that kind of view is called a person-affecting view, namely that views can only be bad in virtue of the fact that a particular person is made worse off. But for example, if you held, I mean, I'll just just put out a view that would be inconsistent with that. If you believed in equality of any kind, right? So if you met, and if you, with that, and you created a person who's better off than average, or you improved the life of someone who's better off than average, then you could make a state of affairs worse without making any individual person worse. Or in fact, it is in the case we create someone, there's no existing person that's made worse. And similar stuff comes about with sort of paths, not identity problems.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Stimulating questions. Probably the concept of harm is a kind of problem. I'm not sure what the distinction in English between harm and damage. So Mickey Mouse could be harmed, but I think that Mickey Mouse could be damaged, but harmed? But maybe your question is concerned with how we should distinguish between harm and damage. So if we adopt the terminology damage, your point is absolutely true, but I'm not sure about if we adopt the harm. And you pointed out that my argument or my refutation of HLTD is based upon the personal point of view, but that is not my point, but Epicurean point. Epicurus focus on the personal point, first person's point of view. So in fact, finally, at the end of the day, I don't perfectly accept the Epicurean view. I aim at somehow refuting Epicurean view. So that's
okay. Let's skip it. I'll try to be quick.
Just about the point about personhood at the end. It kind of sounds like you kind of did. Is well, if I think myself to be a person, you know, it, sometimes during my life, it's kind of.
Excuse me. Could you speak more slowly?
You're kind of personhood at the end. It felt as if you're kind of giving an account of life after death in a certain sense.
Oh.
Right?
Life after death.
It sounded like it. I mean, maybe it's not exactly what you meant. When you say there's a person in some sense after death, that to me sounds like I've survived beyond the grave. Maybe I'm not going to dispute that now, but if that's so, well, then you don't need your own theory at all to review the Epicurean thought, because you can just say, well, no, there is something that survived death. That's what's harmed. And the problem is solved much more quickly. We don't need any argumentation in between.
Okay. Yeah, good point. Yeah. Well, that is kind of religious point of view. So, we human beings have a culture, religion. So, if we think much of religion or a religious point of view, it's okay. But this time, today, I focus on the Epicurean proposal about the concept of death. So, but I admit there is another approach from a religious point of view, as you said.
Okay.
It's okay.
I think you're next.
At some point on the slide, I think you mentioned that you would like this to be universally institutionalized. Did I understand
correctly? Yeah.
And I was thinking in terms of applicability, like in law and politics in general, I would take it that we want criminals in jail from a purely functional role, namely that we don't want them to do this again. So there's a very efficiency-oriented attitude. And also from a philosophical point of view, I'm thinking, well, we don't adopt Hellenism because it could be seen as a form of low-level thinking about ethics. So I think it's quite obvious that Hellenism only applies if you're alive, because it's about pleasure and pain. Right? So once you're dead, pleasure and pain, it does not really apply. But it could be seen in, as... From a historical point of view, that Hellenism is, in a sense, a low-level form of ethical thinking. So you could really just criticize the Epicurean theory coming from a more general view, which is quite... Well, it's historically important, but it's not something that you could really apply in your everyday life.
Points taken. Thank you very much. Of course, I know that the system of punishment has many ends, many purposes, including, as you said, efficiency-oriented purpose. So according to utilitarian theory. But I suppose that even if we expect the system of punishment to have a utilitarian effect, basically we have to adopt the retributive point of view, because if we entirely adopt the utilitarian point of view, it is not necessary for the society to impose a punishment to the offender themselves. If we impose the punishment to the family of offenders, I think it is expected to be more effective to deter the future crimes. So, but even if we adopt the utilitarian point of view, it is not arbitrary whether the punishment should be imposed to the offenders themselves. If we take the steady strategy that punishment should be the offender themselves, I think that it's because at the basic level we accept the retributive point of view. That's my way of thinking. Okay. And hedonism, she mentioned a view of hedonism.
2 minutes.
Hedonism is, of course, not always dominant. I admit that. So, as I said to his question, this time I focus on the Epicurean point. I focus on examining the Epicurean view. So I mentioned the hedonism, I don't think that the hedonism is always dominant. But as you know, I'm Jeremy Bentham. According to Jeremy Bentham, any kind of ethical attitude is subsumed into the hedonism. So, in another sense, hedonism is always dominant, depending on the interpretation of hedonism.
Okay, Seth, I think you're
going to answer. Okay,
Peter.
Yeah, just very briefly, on the hedonism point, I mean, psychological hedonism, I think, is very implausible as a theory of motivation.
Implausible.
Yes. I mean, people are often quite keen on it, but as soon as you think of things like taking out life insurance for the benefit of people after your death, you know, caring about what will happen after your death, those sorts of arguments, I think, undermine also the hedonistic theory of harm. I mean, the idea that we are, that, you know, I'm motivated to help the old lady across the road because it's going to make me feel better, the standard response is putting the cart before the horse. The truth is I feel better because I care about the old lady. If I didn't care about the old lady, I wouldn't feel better. And likewise, taking out life insurance for the benefit of one's children, it's clear that there one's not doing it in the anticipation of personal benefit. And I think if you push those kinds of arguments, it becomes very implausible to measure harm in terms of hedonism.
Okay, before you answer that, we'll just take the last
one. No, it has been raised
already. Okay, so do you want to make...
I admit his point. Hedonism. But
can I ask you a question? Yeah. This is a variant of his question. So imagine that Peter turns out to be a very bad man. He pulls out a hammer and he says, you know, in 5 minutes, at 7:05, I'm going to hit you over the head and kill you with my hammer. Oh. Now we ask, you know, would it be wrong for Peter to hit me over the head at T2? And we say, yes, it would be. It's 7:05. Okay. So is the act of striking me over the head with the hammer at 7:05 on the 16th of November wrong? And our answer right now was yes. And he does that act. And 1 year later, there's a court case, and they say, was it wrong that at 7:05 on the 16th of November, he hit Savulescu over the head with a hammer? We already have the answer now. The answer doesn't change. The act was wrong. This is a variant of the deprivation theory. It doesn't change because I no longer exist, or the act at that point in time was clearly wrong. We've decided that just now in this discussion. Look, I'm alive, I'm dancing, and in 5 minutes' time, he's going to hit me over the head with a hammer. That act will be wrong. And the evaluation in the court is whether that act was wrong. It doesn't matter at that point that I'm dead or the act was wrong and he's deserving of punishment.
I'm surprised that you find that the deprivation theory is so popular.
Why does the status of the act change?
Yeah.
Because now we're 1 year in the future. The act is exactly the same at 7:05 on the 16th of November. Why is it wrong now? Why is it wrong now and it's no longer wrong in a year's time?
But how do you react? React to the fact that victim or killed people has disappeared? Such kind of fact.
Here's another example. Imagine that he steals my money today. I don't know about it.
Yeah.
Okay. and then tomorrow I have a heart attack and die. So I'm dead.
Yeah.
Okay. And then my family find out about that and they say, he stole the money from Savulescu on the 16th of February. That act was wrong. Doesn't matter that I don't exist any longer. I'm dead.
Yeah.
But the act was wrong. On the 16th of
December. Yeah,
see how the evaluation of acts changes over time.
Okay. Julian. All of your point is accepted in our society. Nevertheless, Epicurean view is raised, which seems to oppose to our common view. And it seems a bit difficult to refute Epicurean view in a theoretical and logical way. So we philosophers have to try to refute Epicurean view in order to make our common view persuasive. So your point is concerned with our common view. So I also accept that. Nevertheless, Epicurean view seems to be strange, appear in a strange way, so we have to face that. That's our point, that's my point of today's talk.
So it sounds more like an issue of standing, though, right? So it sounds more like an issue of standing, of who's in a position to make a claim at the point that the victim is no longer alive.
Ah.
As opposed to the fact that whether or not the act was wrong or right, or it should be punished or not punished. So the victim is gone. Who's now going to stand in the place of that victim and make the claim? Who's the wrong to? But you don't want to make the claim about standing, right? Because, I mean, that's sort of just a traditional problem in law that you want to make a claim about the... But you're also not... But in response to Julian's point, are you making a claim about the wrongness and rightness of the act itself, or are you making a claim about our ability to actually, for example, punish an offender by...
Good question.
I mean, do you want to say that those acts at the acts themselves were not longer a victim to, or is your point just sort of about more of a general point about standing or something?
Yes. You point a very crucial point out. So, my answer may be that the two viewpoints that you mentioned are mingled, because as I mentioned, the person, the concept of person, is resonating with others. That's one of my claims. So your point is absolutely acceptable, but I want to answer that those two point of view must be or is mingled in a descriptive way as a matter of fact. So that's our nature for the talking about dead people.
Okay, I'm sorry, I was very naughty, but we've run over. But next time we will have
more.
So, for those of you who have signed up to come to dinner, we will go to Chiang Mai and we'll be leaving now. Thank you, Masaki, for a very provocative.
Very interesting, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you that. It's a question, a topic, which everyone is interested in.